The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back. Yes, it is Monday, January 20th, 2020, as we head into hour two of our 3-hour tour. It's a delight to welcome back dear friend and great scholar Christopher Flannery. Chris is a senior fellow at the Claremont Institute. He's a contributing editor at the Claremont Review of Books, and he hosts the wonderful American Story podcast, that website, theamericanstorypodcast.org. The most recent one, of course, episode 27 on the American Dream, which is perfectly suited to what we commemorate today on Martin Luther King Jr. Day. He has an attendant essay over at the American Mind called The Spirit of 76. Professor, welcome back to the show. Welcome back to the airwaves of Phoenix.
Seth, it's good to be here. How you doing?
I'm doing really well, thank you. And what a great podcast, what a great essay. Thank you for providing it to us. Let's get right to it. Your thesis is that Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech casts a golden thread across three centuries, connecting us to the source of the American dream. I agree with that wholeheartedly. It seems to me that's not taught very much. It's not learned very much when we think about King. But I wondered if you might give us that teaching a little bit, sir.
Yeah, thanks. Well, unfortunately, in many ways, American history and civics are not taught or taught well in a lot of our schools today. So that's a shame. But one of my thoughts is a simple and quick and I think true way to get into that subject could be with the dream speech. And part of my reasoning is, although we hear a lot about the ignorance of American students today and about their history and so on, basically I think practically every American over the age of 12 or maybe 10 is somehow familiar with King's speech.
Mm-hmm.
And so
every American. That's an important point.
That's my claim.
So
we're all familiar with that. And why I say about that partly, first of all, yes, it's true that that's a reflection of a great deal of our ignorance, because I could also, I also do say that practically no American is familiar with any other political speech made in the 20th century.
This is such a key point. I think this is such a great insight. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the idea is, well, let's start with what we are familiar with, and I also would say it's a remarkable serendipity or providence or great blessing that if Americans are going to be familiar with some speech, any speech in the 20th century, that's the one you'd want, to put it that way, because it really explicitly takes it, well, I would say especially figuratively, takes us back to Lincoln's Gettysburg Address in its 50 years rhetoric. It explicitly takes us back to the Declaration of Independence with its appeal to the American creed and its citation of the words, all men are created equal, and so on. So my thought is that it would be a very good standard, universal introduction to American civics to take that King speech, to take Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, which is so short and accessible and wonderful, and to take the Declaration of Independence, read those documents, and reflect on the core teaching of them all, which is the same thing, which is we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. And if you can get each generation of citizens thinking about that in that very accessible way, which is they're already familiar with, I would think that is the right door through which to get a good American civic education.
Agree with you totally, and I love it. The three things, Declaration of Independence, Gettysburg Address, Abraham Lincoln, the I Have a Dream speech. The I Have a Dream speech, of course, most recent, the one we think about on a day like today, Martin Luther King Jr.'s most famous speech, and as you put it, probably the most famous speech of the 20th century, or at least the one most familiar to most people. Really, 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 very interesting. The study of King itself is interesting. What's learned, what's not learned, what's promoted, what's not promoted, what's studied, what's not studied about King. Because if you go through, and I know you've done this, so I don't mean you, Chris, but I mean if generally people go through King's writings, his speeches, many of which you would call, one would call sermons, there's an interesting theme one notices that's kind of different from the rhetoric of today's civil rights movement. And it's something you write about in your essay over at The American Mind. It's something you and I have talked about before, which was, as opposed to so many of the, shall we say, 1619 types, for lack of a better characterization, he actually loved our founding. I've put it this way, and you tell me if you would like to say something about this. There seems to be two views about the American founding in the civil rights movement of today. There's the King view, which believes our founding was based on freedom, with the thought that slavery was an exception to it that needed to be put on a path to extinction, contrasted to the view of so many others today that America was founded on slavery, where freedom was the exception. Isn't that kind of the divide and why people have gotten King so wrong, if not forgotten him? I mean, you go to college campuses, it's not King's face, it's Malcolm X's face, you see.
Yeah, and you mentioned the 1619 project.
Yes, right,
and,
right.
We've talked about that a little bit.
They, right.
It's important to talk about it because it's an educational project sponsored by the New York Times, the MacArthur Foundation, the Pulitzer Center, the Smithsonian Institution, and basically the current American establishment. And it is amazing that Martin Luther King or even Frederick Douglass hardly show up
right
in that curriculum
right
so far.
Right.
And if you're right, that curriculum explicitly says that America is not founded on the idea that all men are created equal, that America is founded on a racist ideology that denies that black slaves were part of that claim of equality. And I think that is just historically untrue. And it is also certainly not what Martin Luther King Jr. thought. And so, the curriculum that our American students, I mean, the ambition of the 1619 Project is that every American student would grow up learning that curriculum. And that curriculum holds that America is founded on not the idea that all men are created equal, but the idea of a racist ideology that holds the black race to be inferior. And I think King would think that, I mean, I can't speak for him, but everything I understand of him would hold that is just historically untrue. And his rhetoric and his sermons, as you rightly point out, all typically appeal to the truth, which is that all men are created equal, whatever their color. And that is the great promise of America, which, yes, we failed to live up to in our founding. We fought a civil war over it. We had 100 years of Jim Crow. We have been very imperfectly living up to that ideal. But it's true, and that really is what is definitive about America. That's King's view, I believe, and that is definitely not the 1619 view.
Or the view of so many in the educational profession these days, right? There has to be, and maybe you see this coming to sharp relief in the presidential campaign as well. One side thinks America or says America can be great or was great, can be great again, and one side thinks it never really was. One side's invested in, shall we say, a down-market view of America, which you could not have had a King and a civil rights movement if that was your view. For what would you appeal to, right? It would be an abyss. You would have no North Star to appeal to, as King did. He saw greatness in our founding. Today's left sees misery in it. Isn't that's the divide we've been trying to overcome, I think, for many, many years. It's why, of course, you and I love Lincoln so much, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, King says the American dream, his dream.
Yeah.
He says, I have a dream that America will live up to its creed.
Right.
And that's and the creed is, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Now, that is exactly as you say, that is to view American history and the truth of American history as being, as revolving around that central claim, what Lincoln called the central idea around which all American ideas radiate, that all men are created equal. A true idea that is, as Lincoln said, the father of all moral principle in us. King was completely within that tradition. I say at his best he was, because I think King was also influenced by some modern trends that we could talk about if you want to. But this dream speech of his, and King at his best, always looked at himself within that American tradition in which the idea that all men are created equal is our moral compass. And it is American, but that's what defines us. Slavery can only be understood from the point of view of that principle.
Right, right. Chris, I want to pick up on that if I can. You can spend a little time with us as is your custom.
Absolutely.
I want to hold you to your original intents with me as well.
Good.
I love talking to you. We are talking to Chris Flannery, who of course is a senior fellow at the Claremont Institute and author of the American Story podcast. Great essay of his, The Spirit of 76 at the American Mind, AmericanMind.org. I'm Seth. We'll be right back with more from Chris Flannery. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Delighted to have with us, staying with us, Christopher Flannery. Dr. Flannery is a senior fellow at the Claremont Institute. He is a contributing editor at the Claremont Review of Books, author of the American Story podcast. You want to check that out, theamericanstorypodcast.org. It's easy to remember because that is the website. Chris, a couple other things on Martin Luther King Jr. I wanted to talk about with you, if I might. You have this, of course, wonderful essay at The American Mind, The Spirit of 76. There's another thing about King that seems to me a little bit out of step with the modern temperament, the modern view of the world. And it's something one picks up in his sermons, which is not only did he believe in the magnificence of the American founding, that we were a good nation at our founding, that we had a solid and strong and ethical founding as opposed to the 1619ers. It's that he had no truck with what you might call philosophical relativism. This was a guy very comfortable speaking, writing, and thinking in terms of absolute right and wrong. I love his Knock at Midnight sermon, where he talks about it being midnight in the moral order, where absolute right and wrong are a matter of what the majority is doing. Right and wrong are relatives to likes and dislikes and the customs of a particular community. Boy, that just flies in the face of all modern political theory, doesn't it?
Yeah, it certainly does. And there is a lot to like in King's thinking. I mean, I was thinking you were going to talk about his Christianity.
I was going to go there next. Yeah, I'm going to do that too.
Yeah.
You bet.
So those things are all compatible. And so one of the reasons why King's political rhetoric, aside from his rhetorical genius, is so powerful, I think, is that combination of things. It's not just, say, the American argument.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just his... You could say classical rational moralism, but it's Christianity, that combination of things, which is a very American combination.
Yes. Right.
And so, yeah, he would talk about our duties and what is right and wrong in light of what is by nature right and wrong. And when I was just reading, because it's Martin Luther King Day, so I'm looking at some of these things today because they're all over the web in good ways, about some of his reflections. And it wasn't even just he, it was someone else on the, there was a Supreme Court decision, and I can't remember even which one it was at the moment. It might have had to do with, maybe it was Brown, but anyway, in which someone in the audience called out, you know, God is speaking today.
Mm.
Because the decision, whatever it was, the decision was a just one.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, so it wasn't, but, you know, and so from a religious point of view, you know, you want to do God's will. You want to do what is right in the eyes of God. And with Lincoln, in our humility, we say, you know, we want to do right as God gives us to see the right.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but that also means, and this is a very American sort of secular way of thinking about it, it means that there is a right and wrong
right.
by nature
right.
that human beings can understand with their reason, just conversations together and working it through. And from a religious point of view, that's perfectly compatible with, of course, what God expects of us and wants of us.
It's all of the same. Yes, it's
combined all of that.
Yes, it's all of the same. It's all of the same theory. It's all of the same thinking, the same concept, right? One can't look to the founding as true, self-evident truth that's spoken of there, right? And be a moral relativist, right? That's his point, or that's the thread.
That's right. And there's another humble way of thinking about that. Our conversation just reminded me of one of the founding thoughts, and that is, we as human beings are fallible.
Right.
And so even while we acknowledge that there is a right and wrong in the world, we know that we as human beings often mistake it. We don't always get it right. And that's why we create limited government.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so there's this wonderful phrase, which I'll paraphrase from the founding, that's, you know, absolute government would be perfectly compatible for God, who is all wise and all good. But for us human beings, limited government is what complements our fallibility and our culpability. So that is not, it's not relativism to admit human fallibility. It's an acknowledgement that there's a right and wrong, and we always want to do what is right and avoid what is wrong. And we construct political institutions to help us do that in our fallibility and our culpability. King, I think, was very alive to all of that.
I'm with you on all of that. That's well put. And then I think there's a fourth or third or fourth leg to this table of King, if you will, if I can create that image for a moment, because it's all of one thing. And that's also this notion of colorblindness, isn't it? If there's an absolute truth, if there's God, if there's man, if there's a difference between the two, then this idea that we all love from the I Have a Dream speech of his wish, dream for a colorblind society, that's, of course, of a piece with that as well. And it's an odd thing that it seems to me a lot of, I've read a lot of African-American or black scholars, female and male, vocally, verbally, rhetorically tell us they resent when white people quote that. And I've never understood why. Because it wasn't just a one-off in that speech. You can see him doing that, versions of that, in a lot of his speeches. I was playing a Selma talk he gave in 1965 where he's talking about not the rights of a black man, not the rights of a white man, but the rights of man as man. It is a continuing theme of his, no surprise. But it is odd that that there's a certain form of pseudo-sophisticated scholarship that doesn't think we whites have a right to quote that or believe it, I suppose. What an odd thing that turns out to be. Have you picked up on some of this, too?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I want to, because I've been thinking about this, that specific thing, and in light of the 1619 Project and so on. So
Let me do this, because that's a big one, and it sounds like you have a lot to say on it, and we got off on my clock just a little bit. Let me take this break. Can I do that? Take this break, and you can unload in full on the other side on this. Is that okay?
Because
I really think this is about the biggest issue there is in our society today. For those of us that actually give a damn about racism and are serious about it, which you and I clearly are, this is a very big point we need to make. I'm Seth. He's Chris Flannery from the Claremont Institute and the American Story podcast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Just a delight and privilege, singular privilege, to be able to call up Christopher Flannery and get him on the show and be enlivened by his teaching and his mind. He is a senior fellow at the Claremont Institute and the host, author at the American Story podcast. We're talking about Martin Luther King Jr., his essay and podcast on the spirit of 1776. Right before the break, Chris, we were talking about how certain self-appointed scholars in the, black civil rights movement or in black studies, African-American studies, people like Michael Eric Dyson and others, tell us that we whiteys aren't allowed to quote Martin Luther King, and certainly not on colorblindness. And it's just an odd, odd thing to me. But you were about to say a bunch of stuff on this.
Yeah, I was going to speak about the principle of this thing.
Please.
And that is, I was looking because it's Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and I have some leisure, and so I'm able to read him and read some other thoughtful people about him. So here's a quotation from him that was in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
So he asks, who is my neighbor? He is neither Jew nor Gentile. He is neither Russian nor American. He is neither Negro nor white. And that, I mean, he says a million different rhetorically beautiful things, but that's one. And I think this is a very characteristic view of Martin Luther King. And that is that what's critical is not our color. It's not even, you know, what our religious beliefs are. What's critical is, as he says in another context, the content of our character. But in any case, when I want to think about my neighbor, I want to think about him as a human being.
Mm-hmm.
That's what matters. And I would have charity toward him and so on. And so there's a quote from Martin Luther King. And just because, you know, we live in the world we live in, it's come to my attention, and it has to others. One of the newly elected members of Congress, Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley.
Uh-huh.
You heard of her?
Yes, she's part of the squad, the lesser known of them, but yes, right.
Yeah, she's not the one named, but here she happens to be a black woman. Not that that matters to me, but it matters to her. And here's what she said. I'm quoting her in a kind of what became a sort of a notorious, famous, or infamous idea of hers. And here it is. I'm quoting her. Speaking to people who are going to be elected representatives in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not prepared to come to the table and represent that voice, don't come, because we don't need any more brown faces that don't want to be a brown voice.
Right.
We don't need black faces that don't want to be a black voice.
Right.
Now, so this is, I think, what we're talking about. Now, that view, which she expresses pretty clearly, is the authoritative view in the world of identity politics, which we happen to live in today. And it is, nothing could be more incompatible with King's view on this subject. And what I think should be the view, and what is the American view, which is that, look, we have black Americans, brown Americans, white Americans, old Americans, young Americans. All of us are Americans. All of us are human beings. And we need to treat one another that way and think of one another that way. But from the point of view of identity politics, which is the view that really predominates from in every university in America today and filtering down into our social life, cultural life, legal life, your views need to be connected with the color of your skin or whatever else identifies you, the gender you choose, you can go down the list. But in this instance of race, which is what we're talking about, this view, especially in my living experience, is connected with Clarence Thomas, for
mm-hmm.
example, and the way that Clarence Thomas has been treated in America since his hearings 30-some years ago.
Can we pick up on this? This is a hugely important point, and it really takes us very far back into philosophical origins of you're writing for the American mind, right? The idea of what is the mind and this idea that race determines thinking. Can we come back on some of
this? Exactly.
Yeah, I'd love to do that when we come back. You and I probably thought the notion died at Nuremberg. Turns out it's well and alive in today's Congress. I am Seth. He is Chris Flannery from the Claremont Institute, and we will be right back. Delighted to have with us Christopher Flannery. He of the American Story podcast, he of the Claremont Institute, where he is a fellow, where I am privileged to be a senior fellow with him. Chris, right before the break, we were getting to this notion, this horrible quote that I think is exactly flying in the face of everything Martin Luther King Jr. tried to teach, this horrible quote by Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley saying, we don't need any more brown faces that don't want to be a brown voice. We don't need any more black faces that don't want to be a black voice. This notion that race determines mind, thought, thinking. It's a terrible retrograde notion, isn't it?
It is. And it is outright in contradiction to the American idea that all men are created equal. That is, if we're all created equal, and we can understand one another as reasoning human beings, whatever our color, and that is the basis of our political freedom. And to me, one of the most poignant examples of this issue coming to the fore came with the Clarence Thomas hearing.
Yes.
And the way that the media and the liberal left viewed Clarence Thomas. Not just the liberal left, but the left among the black community, who would call Clarence Thomas an Uncle Tom,
right,
because he didn't think the way that he was supposed to think, allegedly, mm-hmm, as a, quote, black face. And so Clarence Thomas, to me, has undergone a tremendous, I would say, martyrdom, a political martyrdom. Mm-hmm. As he said, a high-tech lynching,
yeah,
he went through in his hearings. Yeah. Because he chose to think as a human being, as an American, and that did not in any way detract from his being actually a black man in America who really did suffer in his life many of the discriminations that black people in America have experienced. But he refused to think of himself as someone who needed to, so to speak, whose thoughts were determined by the color of his skin, as is expected and insisted upon by Representative Pressley and others of her thinking. So Clarence Thomas, to me, who I think is maybe the greatest living American, his courage and his intellectual profundity really are combined to overcome that really anti-American view that your thoughts are determined by the color of your skin.
Or your ethnicity or any other accident of birth.
Or your ethnicity.
Yeah, I put it crudely. Yeah. I put it crudely to my audience this way. I say things like, if this were true, I would have more in common with Bernie Sanders than I do Larry Elder or Thomas Sowell. And it's not, right? Obviously not. That's the crude way to put it, the subtle way to put it, the smart way to put it. Our teacher, we weren't going to have an interview without invoking Harry Jaffa, is how he put it in his essay, his speech, The Reichstag is Still Burning. Remember, he was talking about the foment in the 60s where people were saying we have to get rid of white education. And he wrote about, what the hell is a white education? He didn't put it that way. He said, do we teach white mathematics or white economics or white biology or white physics? Was there anything in Plato's Republic that indicated it was white justice that Socrates was seeking? Was there anything in the Ethics to indicate that it was white happiness? On and on. You know the quote. You know his line of reasoning.
Yeah.
But if you know what a human being is, you know that race and ethnicity has nothing to do with the measure of the mind or the ability of thinking. It's such an – I'll say it. I believe it's redolent of the Nazis.
Yeah, it is. And it's very troubling. It's very I would say, if you go down, I mentioned the 1619 Project again, but from the MacArthur Foundation to the corporations in America who are really just driven by, ultimately, by the authoritative opinions in our academy and so on, the prevailing view in the world we're living in right now is that our skin color, our ancestry, and other such attributes determine our thinking. And if America is going to overcome that, the tyranny of what is now politically correct, we have to refute that principle. Well, that's a good project.
Yeah.
That's really what we need to do. And by the way, I want to say that Trump, Donald Trump, which we haven't mentioned today, he is someone who instinctively, he's not an academic or an intellectual or anything, but instinctively, he has none of that in him.
Right.
I mean, that view is completely anathema to him.
This is what drives the racialists nuts, by the way, because he's not schooled in that line of thought or thinking. I think he's just totally unschooled in their version of this, where you and I, at least we've spent time in the academy, we kind of know how to do the right talk on this sort of thing if we have to in the right audience with the right crowd, or at least to be sensitive to it. He has no sensitivity to it whatsoever. It's kind of a pure American thought in a way, isn't it?
it is. And I think, by the way, it has taken that kind of instinctive common sense, I think, to stand up to this really tyrannical political correctness, which is absolutely necessary to stand up to if we're going to save the country, it seems to me.
Right. And so I tend to get pretty pessimistic about all of this, because I don't get outside of, I had Robert Woodson on earlier, perhaps you know of his work, but I don't get I don't get a lot of African American or black activists that actually teach the original intent of Martin Luther King Jr. It's hard to find them. So I tend to sometimes be pessimistic. Will you end us here in the next minute or two with an optimistic note about all this, please?
Yes, I will. And first of all, as we all know, despair is a sin. And pessimism is kind of, on its way toward that.
Beautiful.
So be optimistic. So here's one thing I would say. I think that there's a very good chance in November 2020, which is going to be a critical election, assuming we have one. I mean, God knows what's happening with this impeachment business.
Right.
But I think that it's a very good chance that Donald Trump will get, and Republicans will get, a significantly larger percentage of the black vote in November 2020 than they have typically got. And I think that there's a good chance of that because the Democrats have, to their great disadvantage, have gone so far left as to accept all of this identity politics that we've just been talking about, which a significant percentage of the black community reject outright, as every sensible person does. So I think there's a very good chance, how can you predict election, that in November 2020, that the black vote in America and the Latino vote in America will trend more significantly in the direction of Republicans and Donald Trump than it has, and that will become part of a winning coalition that really is going to turn America back in the direction that we're just talking about right now, away from these identity politics, away from political correctness, and toward what really is what this country stands for, the principle that all men are created equal. I think that's a very good prospect, actually.
Well, God, please. Thank you, Chris. That is a great note. I agree with you, by the way, on that, and it drives me from my pessimism, my despair.
Good. That was my hope.
Yeah, no, you did. You reminded me of that great thing. That's why you're the teacher and I'm the student. Chris Flannery, may you continue to be just great, and thank you for everything you've done and for some of your time with us today.
Thanks, Seth. Appreciate it.
We'll talk soon. I'm Seth Leibson. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Blend of 16 whole fruits and a blend of 15 whole vegetables matched with each other in your daily dose of balance of nature, where you don't just get a daily dose, you get 10 servings of 31 different fruits and vegetables. So easy to take. 3 vegetarian capsules is the dosage. Take it with a glass of water. You don't like a vegetarian capsule, they're easy to open and sprinkle into a drink or onto some other food like cottage cheese or yogurt or something like that. We don't want you to wait to see what getting over 10 servings of whole fruits and vegetables every day can do for you. Right now, Balance of Nature is offering free shipping and 35% off any new preferred order of fruits and veggies. Start your journey to better health today. Call 800-246-8751 or go to balanceofnature.com and use discount code BALANCE. I was referencing an essay by a speech by Harry Jaffa, the teacher that Chris Flannery and I were so honored, privileged, fortunate to have. A great political philosopher of our age, died a couple years ago, 2015. And he gave a speech called "The Reichstag is Still Burning." You can get it online. And in it, he revisits the upheaval of the university system in the 1960s along racial lines, along claims of racial superiority and black power. And he talks about, I gave the quote to Flannery, I'll give it to you, when people were talking about a white education, he said he didn't understand that. Were we teaching white mathematics or white economics or white biology or white physics, or for that matter, white political science? Was there anything in Plato's Republic that indicated that it was white justice that Socrates was seeking to define or discover? Was there anything in the Nicomachean Ethics to indicate that it was white happiness that Aristotle sought to the summum bonum? Was there anything in Locke's second treatise of civil government or in the Declaration of Independence to indicate that taxation without representation was unjust only for whites? Was there anything in Locke's letters on toleration or in the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom to indicate that it was only in the case of white human beings that our civil rights have no dependence on our religious opinions any more than our opinions in physics or geometry? I would ask these questions, he wrote. The opposition, however, was uninterested in debating them, which remind me of nothing so much as Karl Marx, who wrote that the philosophers have hitherto interpreted the world. The point is, however, to change it. Right. Revolution without debate, revolution without thought or thinking, revolution without any connection to what's important about the American founding, the American project. We've been very theoretical, historical, and philosophical. We're going to get an update on the impeachment trial, which will start tomorrow, from the great Andy Biggs when we come back. If you're on hold, please stay. We'll be right back.